Welcome. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and this is a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. As I've mentioned a multitude of times in the so far short life of my podcast, that survivors of sexual assault are, more often than not, victimized by people they know, not the pervert hiding in the bushes at the park. And this may be one of the many reasons the majority of sexual assault cases are underreported. The majority of my guests this season are survivors of sexual abuse. Anna Myers, by her boyfriend, Dr. B and Matt Bocci, and myself, my family members. Melissa Dobbs was abused by a much older man who was grooming her as a teenager, but even then she didn't realize that it was abuse until years later. Not one of my guests reported the abuse at the time. Joining me today is Melissa Hotmeyer, Chief Prosecutor of Family Violence in the Special Victims Unit at Prince George's County State's Attorney's Office. Melissa is also a survivor of sexual assault herself. Melissa, thank you so much for joining me for a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you. Well, not only are you a prosecutor whose focus is on family violence and sexual assault cases, but you're also a victim of sexual assault. Would you feel comfortable sharing a little bit about your story?
When I was a freshman in college at GW, at George Washington University, I went out with some friends and had a little bit too much to drink, unfortunately. And I called a person I thought was my friend, who I knew hadn't been drinking because they were athlete on campus, and asked him to come and get me. And, you know, like many survivors, the rest of the night is very blurry for me. And so I just remember bits and pieces of it, but I do remember waking up, not remembering what happened and being unclothed in my bed and just being really scared. And I remember just panicking and going into the bathroom in my freshman dorm and just, I didn't know what to do. You know, I felt like so many survivors feel, that I just didn't know what happened exactly, and I didn't know what to do, and I kind of froze, and I never did anything about it. I told my best friend for weeks she would come and pick me up at my door because he lived just down the hall from me, so that I wouldn't have to run into him alone. And so, yeah, so I just kind of lived with that for a long time.
I mean, you said he was an athlete, and I feel like that could even be more frightening because you don't want anything bad to happen to them. You're just kind of absorbing all the pain that was inflicted on you.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just, I went to him because I knew he was going to be sober, and I thought he was going to be the person to help me. And it just, to have that kind of the person end up being the one who would harm you and cause the harm that you were trying to seek to avoid has just been a lot to process. But you're right, I didn't want him to get in trouble. I wasn't trying to ruin his life, but it was a lot to process at 18.
Yeah, I feel like this does happen a lot on college campuses. And typically, like I said, it's usually someone you know and someone you trust, and they kind of exploit that. You obviously were vulnerable and you were taken advantage of. And I'm sure you know this, but it's not your fault. You are allowed to enjoy life at college and drink. It's not okay for someone else to assault you.
It's taken me a lot of years to get to that point. And a lot of times, you know, telling the survivors that I help now that, and it's kind of like reaffirming it to myself.
Absolutely. I think that's amazing. And I think what you're doing is just so courageous. Why don't we start talking about consent? You know, some people would argue that there are, you know, some gray areas, especially when it comes to the law, and because it varies from state to state and situation by situation. You know, what should people understand when it comes to consent?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I've had a conversation with colleagues and some friends about, you know, consent. And we say, you know, there is no gray zone, but the law doesn't see it that way, right? Most people think of sexual assault laws as no means no. And that is typically what you see in the laws. There has to be some sort of verbal no or some sort of physical resistance, depending on where you are. But I think consent is bigger than that. You want positive consent. What we want to teach people is that you're not just looking for someone to say yes because you've forced them or coerced them to say yes, or because they're incapable of saying yes. You want positive consent. And I think people say, and I've heard the phrase before and I've used it, is FRIES. Consent that is freely given, consent that is reversible, consent that is informed, consent that is enthusiastic, and consent that is specific, meaning specific to the act that you're going to engage in.
That is a good thing to remember and a good thing to teach, you know, your children.
Yeah.
You know, we see this time and time again, especially since the wave of the Me Too movement. You know, do you believe that since the spotlight on sexual abuse, more people are coming forward with their own sexual assaults?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I've seen as a prosecutor, I've definitely seen a rise in historical sexual assaults, meaning cases that happened before, that they're not what we call fresh, meaning they just recently happened. I do think that there's been a rise. I think women are realizing that it's more prevalent, that they're not alone in the trauma that they've experienced. I think there are safety in numbers, right? If you, you think that other people have gone through it, you're more likely to say, hey, this happened to me too, which is, I guess, the whole purpose of the movement. I think it's a great thing. I think it's a great thing that that women are feeling more comfortable, and men, because men are victims of sexual assault too, forward and tell their stories, and that we're putting it out there that it is so prevalent.
You know, although people are coming forward, there's still, you know, many who are afraid to. And, you know, as an attorney working with sexual assault survivors, what are some of the reasons people are reluctant to press charges? I know for you, and even for me, I was sexually abused by my father. You know, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't want the worst thing to happen to this person in some cases.
I think that is the number one reason. I think not wanting something bad to happen to the person who you may have a complicated relationship with, whether it's a family member or whether it's, you know, an ex-boyfriend or a current sexual partner. I think that's the number one reason. I think that the other reason, and it's something that in law enforcement and in prosecution we have to work on, is that our survivors don't think they're going to be believed, you know? And I think that that's a scary thought, to come and say what is probably one of the worst things that ever happened to you, and then you're not believed, is it's hard. And so I think that that's a major reason that survivors don't come forward. And then I think that the thought of having to face your accuser, you know, in court in front of 12 strangers who don't know anything about you. You know, I say to jurors a lot when I try these cases, you know, turn to the person to your left and right and tell them your most intimate sexual moment and see if you can do that without, you know, some sort of hesitation. And now imagine that that sexual moment was forced upon you, you know, so that try to put yourself in the shoes of these survivors who have to come and tell their story in front of people they don't know.
Yeah. I mean, that's powerful.
I hope so.
I know that in Maryland, if an arrest is made in a sexual assault case, the victim is required to testify. This can obviously cause someone to become re-traumatized. Do you believe changes need to happen in the criminal justice system in regards to sexual assault?
Absolutely. I mean, confrontation is nothing that is ever going to change. You know, the U.S. Constitution allows defendants to face their accusers and cross-examine them through counsel. But I do think that there needs to be changes, not only in the criminal justice system. In Maryland, marital rape is still an exception to sexual assault. And so a husband or a wife can't be charged with raping their spouse, except for specific circumstances. And it is something that we've fought, and we are working on changing the law. But, you know, honestly, it really is about a change in the perception of the community, because until we change what our belief of what consent looks like and what rape actually is, I don't think that the criminal justice system is going to change. You know, 8 out of 10 sexual assaults are by someone that is known to the victim. But I don't think that's the perception that our community has, right? We consider rape as somebody who's hiding in a bush, and that's just not reality.
I didn't know that about Maryland, to be honest, so that, you know, you can say no to your husband and your husband can just rape you, and then therefore it's not rape. Maryland, that is very interesting to me. What are you guys doing to make that change?
So we petitioned the legislature in the last legislative cycle to change that law, to just abolish the marital exception, because, you know, in our day and age, there really is no difference between somebody who is dating and somebody who is married. And so why should I be allowed to tell my live-in boyfriend of 10 years no, and then if he sexually assaults me, I can, you know, a prosecutor can charge that. But the distinction of a marriage certificate makes it so that he has some sort of agency over my body and I can't say no. But, you know, it didn't pass this legislative cycle. We're hoping, you know, that next legislative cycle that will change. We'll continue to fight to make that change, because it is something that is so antiquated, and it's necessary because, as we know, women and men can be victims of sexual assault even within a marriage. Mm-hmm. It's important that that distinction kind of goes away.
And why wouldn't it? I feel like, and you know, maybe it's just my ignorance, but I feel like, why wouldn't they want to abolish that law?
I can't speak for the legislator. I know that the pushback was, you know, and it always is in terms of these types of laws, the sanctity of marriage. But obviously, if you are in a position where you're sexually assaulting your spouse, that sanctity is gone. And we know, you know, because the laws have changed in reference to domestic violence, that violence can happen in the home and that we should protect people from that violence. And so changing the law is kind of an imperative part in ensuring that women have agency over their body, whether they're married to somebody or not.
Thank you for that bit of information. That's fascinating to me. You know, physiological responses like an erection, arousal, or an orgasm are involuntary. And that means, you know, your body might react one way, even though you're not consenting to the actual activity. So, you know, as a prosecutor, have you actually seen, you know, perpetrators use this defense, physiological responses occurred to kind of minimize a survivor's experience by using phrases like, you know, you wanted it, or they orgasm, so that was consent, they enjoyed it?
Absolutely. I think that it's absolutely a defense that we see all the time. I've seen it in stranger cases, and I've seen it in cases where the, you know, the parties know each other. I've seen it even in like where the survivor has confronted the abuser and they're like, well, you know, you liked it. And they're like, no, that's not what happened. You know, I said no, or I was passed out. And it's still, unfortunately, a huge part of what I, and I think a lot of prosecutors experience in prosecuting cases. You know, I remember a case that I had a few years ago where, you know, they just kept talking about her panties and like they just kept bringing them up, like, you know, the kind of panties she was wearing, as if, you know, passing out in the back of an Uber, that, you know, because she was wearing those underwear that you know, said that she wanted it. And, it, you know,
she was asking for it.
Yeah, she was asking for it. Which she obviously was not, because she was not in any state to be asking for anything other than a ride back to her house. And even that she couldn't even really consent to because she was unconscious. And so it's just unfortunate, a part of our society. And I think it won't change in the criminal justice system till it changes within our country, that people understand that nobody is asking for it, that you can't ask for it unless you are verbally asking for it.
I hate the idea of blame the victim because of what she was wearing, or blame the victim because they were looking at me like they were interested, or they were dancing with me, or, you know, it is very frustrating. And I think, you know, like you said, this is something that needs to be discussed within our community, and consent. We see the culture of consent evolving, obviously, because, you know, we get to talk about this, and, you know, I feel like talking about this is progress, but we still have a long way to go, you know, especially since the 80s and even the 90s in such movies like 16 Candles.
I did a piece of ass anytime I want. Shit, I got Carolyn in the bedroom right now, passed out cold. Could violate her 10 different ways if I wanted to.
Animal House, Grease. And even Beauty and the Beast, which I didn't realize when, you know, Gaston's like, how dare she rebuff my advances?
Who does she think she is? That girl has tangled with the wrong man. No one says no to Gaston.
Darn right.
Many kids grew up watching these movies, you know, and I feel like there's a reason why people, at least who were, you know, teenagers in the 80s and 90s, kind of grew up thinking like, oh, it's okay because it was part of entertainment. You know, in 16 Candles, the hero says, you know, I could violate her 10 different ways, when his girlfriend was passed out drunk, and then he passes her on to some guy who they, I guess they consider the geek. So this popular guy is now considered a hero because he passed this popular drunk girl onto this guy. You know, do you think that conveying these messages as comedy and entertainment has contributed to rape culture in high schools and college campuses?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I loved 16 Candles too, and Beauty and the Beast. But when you really think about it, and like, these are the messages we're sending to our kids, whether they're, you know, very young, like my girls who are 3 and 5 who love Beauty and the Beast, or whether they're preteens and teens watching something like 16 Candles, we are, I mean, having those images and it being entertainment and not considered horrifying, which when I watch it now, I'm horrified by, of course contributes to it, because then the mentality is of it's okay, you know, and we see it constantly. At least we did. I think it's changing now. We see it constantly, and it's just ingrained in our psyche, and it becomes part of what we think about. So we don't consider the jock passing off an unconscious girl to the geek as sexual assault because it's just funny. And it absolutely is. I mean, she can't consent. And so, of course, I think it feeds into the rape culture that we have in our community. And it's incumbent upon us, as much as we love and think about those movies in such a good way, to talk to our kids about the problems with it.
I do believe those are teachable moments. Like, I was watching Sandlot the other day when the kid pretends to drown so he can kiss the lifeguard. And I was thinking, well, I guess if I do let her watch them, these are going to have to be teachable moments.
Absolutely.
So it's like, oh, do I not let her watch it? But again, I guess it is an opportunity to definitely have these conversations where you say, hey, that's not okay, you know, regarding the culture of rape on college campuses. But, you know, the former Stanford swimmer is seared in my head. You know, he was sentenced to 6 months for rape of Chanel Miller behind dumpsters with witnesses. I don't believe he served the full 6 months. You know, it kind of infuriated me, you know, like any traumatic event, one moment can really change a person's life. And, you know, as a prosecutor and as a survivor, do you find yourself in situations where a judge or a jury do not see the crime as life-changing as it is?
Yeah. I mean, I sometimes see, you know, unfortunately, law enforcement not seeing it that way. You know, I think we live in a society that you see a murder or you see a robbery and people recognize the harm out of that. And I'm not trying to, you know, diminish the harm that those victims feel, because they do. And I've prosecuted those cases as well. But I think people think you're going to get over a sexual assault. And you know, what I say, because of my own experience, is you're never going to be the same. You know, I think that I have thrived and I've used my experience for good. At least I hope I have. And I hope that the victims that I help use their experience to help others and to move forward and become a better part of themselves. But I don't know who I would have been, good or bad, had what happened to me my freshman year not happened to me. And you know, that is something that I think judges and jurors don't think about, and defense attorneys don't think about. You don't just move on from it. There are moments where it just comes back to you in a flash. When I have cases that are similar to the fact patterns of my case, sometimes get anxiety thinking about, you know, my own experience. And it just, to diminish what survivors go through, and it's just, it's a shame. And mm-hmm. I don't have an answer to it. But it is something that I know that, you know, is a frustration of mine and so many other survivors.
My mom always taught me, if you don't think about things that bother you, then they won't bother you. But, you know, that's not true. You know, things manifest in certain ways. And like you said, when you see a case that's similar to your own, you know, you are triggered. Your traumatic event is triggered. And, you know, that shouldn't be happening. It is a shame that a lot of people who've never been through it can't empathize, or maybe they don't want to empathize, because it is a horrific situation to be put in.
I think people are sometimes like, it would have never happened to me, or that wouldn't happen to my child, because they would never put themselves in that situation. You know, I hear that a lot, and I'm like, you just don't know. You don't know. No. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, and I feel like that goes again with blaming the victim. I do get tired of hearing people blame the victim.
Yeah, but, me too. Yeah.
But well, before I let you go, you know, you and I are both mothers, and you know, I want to know, what can parents do to raise children to recognize what is and what's not acceptable behavior?
So I think it's so important to teach kids from a really young age about, you know, autonomy and consent over their own bodies and their parents' bodies. You know, I have taught my girls about the real names for their body parts, because I think it's really important for them to, you know what the names are, so that if somebody, you know, talks to them about it or tries to touch them or touches them there, they can verbalize what happened, but also that they have the right to say no. You know, whether that's no to their parent or whether that's no to, you know, a relative or family friend that makes them feel uncomfortable, or whether it's no to a complete stranger who shouldn't be anywhere near them, but they need to know that it's okay. You know, and I think that that's the most important lesson that you can teach your kids, you know. And it was hard, I think, for my husband at first to grasp it, because, you know, he'd start tickling them and then they'd say stop, and he would stop even though he didn't want to. And, you know, they were like, well, why are you stopping? And he said, well, you said stop, and what you say, it's your body, it's your choice. And at first he thought I was crazy, and then he realized, you know, it's right that they get to choose who touches them and when, and then when it stops. And if we're not teaching our kids from an early age that they have the right to say no, even once they've said yes, then it's going to be harder for them as they grow up to make that choice. Because, you know, if they can't make that choice with a loved one who loves them unconditionally, then they certainly may not be able to make that choice for somebody who they, you know, kind of are interested in, want them to like them.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, especially when like a grandparent or an aunt wants a hug and a kiss and, you know, your kids don't want to, you know, I'm used to being told, just go ahead and give them a kiss. Come on, you know, just kind of coercing them to do it. And I feel like by teaching them that, you're making it harder for them to be able to say no. And absolutely. Then as an adult, it just gets worse. So, you know, I completely agree with you there. You know, I actually bought my son a book when he was like less than a year old called My First Book of Feminism. It was like a hard book. And it's my first book of feminism for boys. And it was so cute. But then I thought, you know, should I be even making this an issue now? You know, there are points in the book where it talks about, you know, no means no. When someone doesn't want to be touched, you know, don't touch them. But I feel like, I guess saying it now to you, I'm like, oh, that does make sense. I feel like I say that to my son all the time. Keep your hands to yourself. But should we be making an issue about it even as early as like infancy?
Yeah, because I think it becomes part of, you know, who we are. We grow up with telling our kids, you know, please say please and thank you. And we want them to be polite and, you know, treat elders with respect. And so if we want them to have those kind of values, we want to have them to have the same values with regards to consent and making sure that they understand their own ability to consent and that other people have the ability to consent. You know, it's a little bit of both ways, right? We want them to know they have autonomy, but we want them to understand that other people's autonomy needs to be respected as well. And so I think it should be part of what we teach them, just like we teach them all of the other, you know, ethics we want them to stick by as they grow up. So I think it's important to start as young as you can. I mean, using language that they will understand. You know, you're not going to talk about consent. You're going to say, like you said, you know, I don't like to be touched that way. When I say no, please don't touch me. And then, you know, the language can increase as they get older.
Well, Melissa, is there anything else you'd like to add?
You know, like we've talked about before, I just think consent is such an important issue in our country. I think, you know, it's important for the kids and for parents to understand, you know, that we need to be kind of spreading it and understanding it so that everybody can feel comfortable. And so just thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for your expertise in talking about this important topic and, you know, being vulnerable and just sharing your personal story. I feel like a lot of people will get a lot of valuable information from our conversation. So thank you.
Thank you.
That was Melissa Hopmeyer, Chief Prosecutor of Family Violence and Special Victims Unit at Prince George's County State's Attorney's Office and fellow trauma survivor Thriver. For more information about Melissa, please visit atstpodcast.com. That's the letter A, atstpodcast.com. There you can find her social media handles. Thanks for being a part of the conversation. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and you've been listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. Take care.